this and I'll post it. So I'm Rick Hansen, and as usual, and still, darn, I get a little bored with myself. Don't you get bored with yourself sometimes? Because you've heard your own shtick. But anyway, and this is February 20th, 2013, and we're doing kind of questions and comments and stuff. So question on the table, if you're upset, you're in the moment, you're activated, fight or flight or freeze, right? They said it. They cut you off. They flipped you off. You know, you open the refrigerator and you were looking for the cream, they took the last of the cream, right? Something's happened, okay? Or worse, you know, something terrible maybe. You got that, I remember going to see the dermatologist for a standard mole check about a year and a half ago, and she saw this kind of mole in my ear and she paused and said, that doesn't look good. Four words you don't want to hear from a doctor. I'm okay. They pulled it out. It was as good as it can get to have a little bit of cancer, but it was the real deal. So what do, right? The first thing to do really is pause, mindfulness. What's happening, right? That's just the very first thing. How many times have you gotten yourself in trouble by pausing to reflect compared to just letting it rip? Then the odds are much better. Once in a while, we shouldn't pause to reflect. You know what I mean? We should slam on the brakes or jump, you know, get out of the burning building. But most of the time, we really serve to reflect. So to pause. And what helps to be able to pause is to practice offline so that when the oatmeal hits the fan, we have acquired a lot of resources to stabilize and observe. Right? So we practice, in a way, we practice for the crises, right? And then when they happen, then we've built up inclinations. We're inclining the mind, as it were. So that's the first thing, is to pause. And I do little things like exhale, because that activates the parasympathetic wing of the nervous system that calms us down. The heart beat slows down slightly as we exhale, because that's so-called parasympathetic activation. It speeds up a little when we inhale, that sympathetic nervous system activation. Exhaling, whatever works for you. Just pause, gather yourself, look. Second thing is to have self-compassion. You know, I think there's a place for being warm-hearted. It's interesting about the rap on Buddhism as this kind of austere, bummer religion, right? And actually, it's interesting how warm-hearted it is and how warm-hearted the Buddha himself was. And also, new scholarship is showing that in very important ways, the Buddha said that love was a fully complete path of awakening. That's quite a radical thing to say. So can you find some warm-heartedness for yourself in the moment that you're upset? And right there is a really important moment. Now, the clock's ticking, right? So we're about 4 seconds in. Something has happened, you've noticed it's happened, and, you know, so the beginning of some top-down wisdom is coming into the stream. Chill, don't throw any more gasoline on this fire. What the heck, okay, is happening here? Let's pause. And then a few more seconds tick by, and you start to mobilize some, ouch, this hurts. I don't like feeling angry. The Buddha said that getting angry at others is like throwing hot coals with bare hands. Both people suffer, right? We want to have a kind of kindness to ourselves that, ouch, this hurts, right? You know, the brick falls on your foot, someone is mean to you, or something arises and you're worried about it yet again. In that moment, can we mobilize compassion for ourselves, the wish that we not suffer? It's as simple as that. What would we feel toward a friend who is having the same mind stream, the same brick on the foot, the same, oh, that doesn't look good about the cancer, or the same financial setback? What would we feel? We'd have a sweetness toward them. Okay, so far? Right? this bit right there, this kind of sweetness for oneself, is so really important. And again, we cultivate it offline, right? We practice sweetness for ourselves, not self-pity, not narcissism, but a kind of basic lovingness toward ourselves, a friendliness. You may know the word from Pali for loving kindness practice, metta, metta practice. May you be happy, may you live with ease, and so forth. The root of that word is friendliness, is friendship. We're being friendly toward ourselves. We know how to be friendly toward ourselves, right? Are we friendly toward ourselves when we're upset? A lot of research on self-compassion these days, how incredibly powerful it is for dialing down the stress machinery of the brain and reducing self-criticism, because that's often what's happening when we're upset. And then also increasing resilience and buffering the heart against cardiovascular disease and building up a sense of personal worth. Pretty good. Okay, I'm describing my personal first aid kit. I don't always do it, but I'm pretty habitual about it. Now, the third thing is to kind of get on our own side. As the Buddha said, I scanned, you know, and I scanned the cosmos, and I found no being more worthy of happiness than I. Now, he didn't mean that like, I'm the Buddha. I'm so cool, right? He didn't mean it that way. He meant it as, like, anyone scans the cosmos. No being is more worthy of happiness than you, or you, or you, or you, or you. Look in the mirror, you know? How about it? Close the door, make sure no one can hear you. Look in the mirror and say, you, no one in the cosmos is more worthy of happiness than you. Wow, that would be pretty hard, wouldn't it? You know, think about that. So it's getting on our own side, being for ourselves, not against others, but for ourselves, wishing ourselves well, being an ally to ourselves. Right? Okay? And we start to go, I don't want to feel bad. You know, the Buddha, again, really stressed, as other people have it too, that deep down, let's practice for other people, but fundamentally we practice for ourselves. You know, we hold ourselves to account, and we practice for ourselves. So this is an aspect of that. Get on your own side. And then, for me, the next thing I do is I start to make a plan. I start trying to figure out what to do. How do I understand this? What's going to be helpful? I try to, like I'm sure you do, pull up what I know about dealing with tricky situations like this, or how am I going to pay this bill, or whoa, that doesn't look good. I'm going to go see my wife and I were so on top of melanoma, you know, in 36 hours, we were like, whoop, you know, take action. One of the things that really wrecks people when they're upset is they don't take action. It's really important to take action. And then so make a plan and then initiate around it. So for me, that's not the entirety of it all, but that's a lot of it. And to wrap up my answer here, I'll introduce this, which again, could be familiar to some of you, a fundamental teaching about the first and the second dart. You know, how many of you know this teaching about, how many of you don't know this metaphor of the first and second dart? Okay, fresh meat, no. What I mean is, no, very briefly then, the Buddhist metaphor is that things happen, they create physical or emotional pain. The brick lands on our foot, or someone we love passes away, or mistreats us, or something happens. We want to join a group, we're excluded. Okay, that's the first dart of life. The second dart is this whole cascade of reactions that we add ourselves. And so again, another thing I'm trying to do in that event is get back as elementally as possible to what is this experience exactly? What are the body sensations? What are the emotions? What are the perspectives, the thoughts? What are the images or memories? How is this being conditioned by my own psychology, landing on me for various reasons, reaching back into my childhood, you know? And then what are my inclinations here based on what's happened? You know, I'm trying to get, rather than this whole complicated story upon story upon story about it. Okay. Got that? So what's your first aid kit? Think about it. So pause, for me, it's pause, self-compassion, get on my own side, make a plan, and take action. Those five. Great.
I shared this at Linda's, but I didn't quite understand it when I did. But I think I do a little bit better now. Someone yelled at me at WildCare, our supervisor for my shift. And she said, "I told you three times to take that garbage out." Now, I'm really not used to being talked to like that.
It's been a while.
And I went through some, what you said, kind of accidentally, because I had to do my work. So time intervened.
Yeah.
During that time, there were sort of two opposite tracks. Mm-hmm. One was I was calming, and I was planning every possible argument to lay on her at the end of the shift.
Right.
I had a whole list that was scanning the universe itself. There was so much I was going to tell her.
No one in the cosmos more worthy of criticism than her.
Longer list than I did to tell Kim at the last moment of our shift.
Yeah.
So that moment came, and all of a sudden, it wasn't personal.
Hmm.
And then, at the same time, all of a sudden, I knew what action to take.
Yeah.
And I hugged her. And I said, "I always enjoyed working with you." And we had a nice hug in the hallway. And the rest of both of our days was elevated.
Right.
And what had happened before was only leading up to, for me, being seen it with less personal connection. And for both of us, having some physical contact that was calming and pleasant.
Yeah.
And
thank you.
I couldn't remember what happened. I couldn't remember my list. It was gone.
Yeah. Thank you. Great. No, I appreciate that. Yeah.
I have a follow-on. We've had a couple of different examples.
Mm-hmm.
You had an example about the cancer in your ear.
Mm-hmm.
Robert had an example about a colleague who said something about taking out the trash. Whatever. What if it's someone who you're in a relationship with, a work relationship, a love relationship, family, whatever, who says something that really is cutting to the core and actually shakes the foundation of your understanding of how you sit in that relationship? It's something really cutting. And, you know, maybe it's part truth to it, but it really is damaging. How do you work with that? How do you react to that? Still the same principles?
Hmm. Yeah, and so first a little bit of a frame here. I think there are many ways, of course, to relate to these sorts of things. And I, you know, have only a very partial take on it. Second, if you'll allow me, I'm going to deliberately respond, you know, and relate to it very much in a Buddhist frame. Mm-hmm. If I'm wearing my clinical psychologist hat with civilians, as it were, I might do that in a different way. But I'm going to, because this is this particular setting, I'm going to kind of go there. So for starters, how many of you, if you don't mind just saying, when Tom was telling that, and he was in the experience of it, obviously, felt something like what I felt, which was a quality of compassion for him, right? Kind of an awe. We were moved. So I think that one part of it is to appreciate the compassion of others. Like I saw your faces change when I told you the little story of the cancer in my ear. You didn't know if I was okay. And I could see that. And I could let that in. I mean, so much of the problem in life is we don't let in the good stuff that's right there. It's like life is placing the giant bonbon in our hand, and we don't put it in, right? So right off the top, when there's that opportunity to take in support from other people or other good things, you know, do we actually make use of it? and let the sweetness come in. So that's the first thing. And then second, to have that feeling for ourselves. So then after that, a couple things I'll say about that. I'm reminded of what the Dalai Lama said when people were very critical of him. He said, well, now this is a guy who is the Dalai Lama and also, you know, meditates for 2 hours every morning, basically, from 4 to 6 a.m., as well as other practices during the day. He says, well, honestly, I'm paraphrasing. He said, first of all, I try to see the part that's true. And I may not like it, but I try to help myself recognize the part that's true and then act accordingly, you know, make amends or take, you know, to do something about it. And then I also try to see separately the part that I just don't think is true, you know, or it may be true, but it's not a problem, or it's this big a problem, but not as big a problem as they're coming at me with. So then what I do is I see the part that's true and that I need to learn and take action on, and I'm at peace with that part. And then I see the part that is not true or not worth being upset about, and I get to peace with that part, and then I'm totally at peace. Flippin' Dalai Lama. Yeah. So that's part of it, and I just want to speak to that if I could a little more. First, I have truly found for myself, and I think it's a very interesting thing, and I don't know why it's true, which is I'm never free until I take maximum reasonable responsibility for my part. And if I'm not free, if I'm still not at peace, interesting metaphor again from the Buddha of a dog tethered to a stake. Chained to a stake. You know, the dog has some freedom of movement, right? But they're not. That dog's not going to get far from that stake. You know, it's going to orbit that stake. And when, you know, you can get clear of something and you're complete with it. It doesn't bother you. Whereas other things keep coming up, you know. And often the reason they keep coming up is we haven't somehow completed our sense of responsibility for it. Whatever that is. Again, doesn't mean that we're beating ourselves up, shaming ourselves. It certainly doesn't mean that. But it means that we take responsibility. And that's one of the hardest things to do, especially in a loving and intimate relationship, especially if there's a lot of muck mixed in with the kernel of truth or in what the other person's saying. So I try to myself look at that, and then the question becomes, how can we resource ourselves to do the really hard thing of seeing clearly and taking appropriate responsibility. Not too much, but not too little. So that's where self-compassion can come in, feeling this nurturance from other people, ouch, that really hurt, feeling that we have allies standing with us, that's so important to have that sense of allies with us. And that helps us face our moral faults. You know, I think of the steps in AA, which I don't know deeply, but there's the step fairly far along where you take a searching personal inventory, et cetera, et cetera. Is that the first step? No. What's the number of it?
That's the
fourth. Yeah, so you lay this foundation down first. So I think of that bit. Another thing in what Robert said, you may know the story of the Buddha and when he was a gorilla. Do you know this story? It's a very cool story. I used it in Buddha's brain. So, okay, how many of you don't know the story of the Buddha when he was a gorilla? Okay, good now. So this will be even fresher for most of you. So I use this as well for myself. Here's the story. So it's one of the Chatuka tales. So supposedly, just by the metaphor, maybe real, who knows. Back before the Buddha was a full Buddha, he was incarnated as a gorilla. And back then, animals could talk. So during this time, a hunter found his way into the forest and got lost and then fell into a deep hole. And he could not get out of the hole. He called and called and called. Nobody came. No water, no food, weaker and weaker. Finally, far, far away, the Buddha gorilla heard his calls and, moved by compassion, came over to help the man. So he looked over the edge of the hole when he finally arrived, looked down, see the man. The gorilla says, "Hello, man." The man says, "Get me out of here." So the gorilla says, "Well, let me check it out." He crawls down into the hole, very steep hole. Says, "Wow, I need to practice, man, before I carry you out. I'm going to roll several boulders down into this hole and then lug them out. And when I know I can do this safely, I'll get you out of the hole." So the gorilla rolls several boulders down into the hole, and then one after the other holds a boulder and then climbs up out of the hole with vines and rocks and all the rest of that, right? Finally, the gorilla says, "Okay, I'm ready. I'm ready, man. We're going to get you out of the hole." So the gorilla climbs down very carefully, gets the man, and with great effort, finally gets the top of the hole, pushes the man out of the hole, and then with his last ounce of strength, the gorilla crawls out of the hole. Whew. The man says to the gorilla, "Now, can you guide me out of the forest?" The gorilla says, "Whoa, I'm really tired. I'll guide you out of the forest, but I've got to rest first. Let me take a little nap." Okay? So the gorilla falls asleep. The man is very glad to be out of that hole, and then he starts thinking. He starts feeling how hungry he is. He starts getting confident again. "You know, I can get out of this forest." He looks at the gorilla and says to himself, "This is just an animal. He got me out of the hole, but he's an animal. I'm a man. How about I take one of these big boulders, smash it on his head, kill him, drink his blood, eat his flesh, and strengthen myself, then find my way out of this forest." So he does. He reaches down, the man does, picks up a big boulder, leans over the head of the sleeping gorilla, drops it on his head. The gorilla awakens with his head being smashed with a rock. Right? Isn't killed, is dazed, blood streaming down the face of the gorilla as he sits upright, looks at the man, who realizes in horror that he didn't kill the gorilla. This is a big, strong gorilla. In that moment, the gorilla sees what has happened. He sees the fear in the man's face. He understands. Tears start streaming down the gorilla's face. And he looks at the man with great sorrow and says to the man, "Poor man, now you will never be happy." That's the end of the story. "You'll never be happy, man, because the consequences of your actions here. You did a terrible thing. Those consequences will follow you," in the Buddhist metaphor, as a shadow follows us, inescapable. The gorilla was not moved to anger, was not going to be vengeful, even though he clearly had the right to a very serious grievance. The gorilla also had a sense that it wasn't really up to him to make sure that justice was served, that there was a natural process of justice being served. That's the story. That's where it ends. We don't know what happened to the man. I'm sure the gorilla in the story did not attack him. Maybe my little evil corner of my heart, maybe the gorilla guided the man back to his village and then guilt-tripped him forever. I don't know. But probably not, hopefully not. That wouldn't be consistent with the story. But you get the idea. So for me, that's been an incredibly powerful story to realize first that people do what they do based on all kinds of causes. Think of all the causes at work in the man's mind. So think of all the causes at work in the people who just are mean to us. It's not just what they say, but the something behind it, the topspin behind it, the itting us behind it. What I mean by that, according to Martin Buber, there are three great modes of relationship: I, thou, I, it, it, it. I, thou is when we treat another person as a being, even if there's a differential between us of some sort. I, it, as we treat another person as a means to our end. We kind of forget who they really are as a being. Maybe they're just a lightning rod for our worked upness. They're not landing on us as a real person. And then it is kind of bodies in space, like people being in an elevator together or just kind of moving through a busy city sidewalk. We can feel it when we're being itted by another person. And in that moment, someone who we thought loved us is now itting us or dismissing us or using us is very wounding. So we recognize, though, that that happened not to diminish the pain of it or potentially the moral indictment of it, or, you know, that we might authentically believe is appropriate for over there. Still, they did what they did for 10,000 reasons upstream. And we kind of have a feeling for that. Their life, their personality, their DNA, their culture, their, you know, the phase of the moon, their Enneagram point, their Myers-Briggs type, you know, their psychodynamics, their everything, their whole story, their story with us, everything, the fact that their back hurts, just all of it, you know, whatever it is, we kind of take that into account. It doesn't sting so much. You know, the Buddha, again, used very often the metaphor of disentangling or being entangled. When we start to appreciate the many threads that are involved in this knotted moment, it doesn't have the same impact on us. It lands more and more as this sort of almost like a nebulous cloud than something just pounding on us from this other person. You see, it's the Dharma right there in someone being, I'm going to use the word, someone being shitty to us. Right there, you can see so much teaching. So I think about that. And maybe I'll just wrap up because I can see a couple hands. I know you wanted to say something, you. So for myself, I do a process internally. First, I honestly ask myself, can I really process with this person? And, you know, I come from a culture of talking. Human potential movement, psychology, 70s, LA. That's my background. And I've come to appreciate the limits on talking with people. Especially some people. And you realize, you know, is this going to actually help? Are the conditions right for actually this being productive? Maybe they are, maybe they're not. You know, so I ask myself that. I ask myself, would it be appropriate to talk later? I ask myself that. And then I would say, I get to a point, I've never found this in the Dharma, where one of the most useful things for me around communicating with other people, it's funny, I can feel myself getting charged up talking about it because it's been very important to me personally, is to, as I put it, to speak for myself. What I mean by that is to both speak my own experience and to focus on my experience rather than my positions or views or policy recommendations, right, or solutions. Mostly just my experience, you know, what this feels like here. But the second, the deeper part, is to realize that I'm mostly not talking to influence the other person, or I'm not at all talking to influence the other person. Very often we're motivated to communicate out of some effort to influence the other person, to get them to see it our way, to understand the extenuating circumstance, to promise to never do it again, to really understand how we feel, even if they don't approve of it or agree with it, right? And there's a place for that. But to the extent that we're caught up in trying to influence the mind stream in the black box over there, we're in trouble. Our happiness is at the effect of what they do. And so for me, it's been really a felt shift, and you might know the experience of this shift, where most of your communicating is, if not all of it, is independent in a sense of them. You're present with them, but you're not bound by them. In the language of object relations, you're not object referenced in your communicating. You're not other referenced. You're following the thread of your unfolding truth. So it's a funny art to be both warmly aware of the other and also virtuous and moral in how you communicate while fundamentally communicating for yourself. And that's been deeply, deeply important for me. And then I'll just wrap on saying this, that the last thing that I find that really helps me is to track the suffering of the other person and to let it land. It helps me be nicer to others and be a better person. But it also helps me feel better to realize, wow, you're suffering over there. Music accompanying. So hopefully that. How about the three people left, and then we'll wrap up in just a few minutes, if that's okay. So.
You just answered my question about the very last thing you said.
Yeah. Okay. I'll say one more little thing,
yeah.
If I could. You may have seen me demonstrate this, so I'm going to ask you to imagine it. Imagine that when you start out in a relationship, the sphere of it, the space of it, is like a circle, okay? And then various things happen. And you realize, aha, I can't really talk with this other person about money. So you carve that little bit out, right? And then something else happens, and you realize, aha, we should not speak after you've had a couple beers. So you carve that out. And then another little thing happens. I really can't loan you my hammer because you never return tools. And then that happens, right? And then you realize, whoa, if I tell you something in confidence, I can't really trust that because the next thing I know, it's on Facebook, right? So you see that. And then you have this very gerrymandered, if you will, space of a relationship. But the scope of it is supported by the underlying causes and conditions of safety. Relationship can't be bigger than the authentic underlying conditions of safety. Otherwise, it's dangerous, right? If a relationship is smaller than the underlying factors or conditions that support it, that's a lost opportunity. But sometimes what happens is that we shrink the size of the relationship with people over time to the space that's safe. Let's say they do something, there are many, you know, they do an event, we try to see if we can repair, and then you see what happens. If we're very sincerely engaged with attempts at repair and the other person won't repair, you realize, aha, I need to shrink the size of this relationship. Where it gets tricky is if you're related to them or own a house with them or have children with them. But then you do the best you can, but it's a general principle for me. And again, to feel autonomous and able and free unilaterally over here to shrink the relationship to a size that's safe and to try to forge basic understandings or agreements with people that they don't yell at you or they don't break agreements or they don't cheat on you or they don't sneak off and get high and not tell you or whatever it is, you know, that you, whatever you need or that they pay their rent on time or come to work, you know, awake rather than hungover. Whatever it is. And if they can't do that, well, then you have to shrink the size of the relationship. Okay. So you probably had something about this.
You're answering a lot of my questions because shrinking the size of the relationship often kills that relationship because when you don't feel safe,
yeah,
you really are, you know, you feel like you're withholding.
Yeah. That's true. And then you have to deal with it. And it's sometimes difficult. What I have myself done, sometimes I've realized that it's not appropriate for me to shrink the form of the relationship. I still need to visit those people for the holidays. You know what I mean? But what I mean... Oh, yeah.
Like you say, having children and being in the same house.
Yeah.
You know, depending on each other for cooperation.
Oh, yeah, and sometimes it's very difficult.
I think that your solution, though, you're talking about, you don't take it all personally. I think that's what we get into, and then maybe shrink it more than we need to because we're taking it personally, and we're thinking that we're at fault or we're pointing the finger outward all the time and not looking to see where we can.
Yeah. That's right. I'll just say this again quite briskly. Recently, there's someone who's fairly significant in my life that I've been just kind of internally processing with, because this person, it's not very viable to process with the person. So what to do? And recently, I was trying to help myself forgive the other person. There's a place for that if it's authentic. But I realized that where the real action was inside me was forgiving myself for my own screw-ups, my own well-intended but blundering efforts, my not-so-well-intended efforts. And that was important. Pardon me. And the second thing was to realize that all I could do was to let the invitation be there. And the other person had to walk through the door. And when I kind of got to that place, it really, a whole peacefulness came over me. And honestly, I felt untethered from the stake. I felt I was free again, you know. And I think, just to your point, really, sometimes what happens with people is we keep asking ourselves, what helps me be truly free? Again, in the Buddha Dharma, this is a teaching of liberation, you know. And it's appropriate and fine to relate to it in a kind of simple, downtown sort of way, you know. Be a little more aware, be a little nicer. That's kind of, you know, that's good. That's better than the alternative, right? But, hey, the Buddha always talked about liberation. So we're, you know, I was just rereading this quote from Upandita on my wall at home, my little home office. He said the purpose of Buddhist practice, I think I quoted this last week, was to expand the range of life conditions in which we are free, right? To become freer and freer, including ultimate freedom. And so what brings us to freedom, you know, in our relationships and in life in general? And ask yourself, you know, are you interested in, I think of it, they ought to name a political party after it, peace and freedom, right? Are you, you know, what's your interest in peace and freedom? And what will take you, that's right, that will take you all the way there. Yeah. Okay, how about, I'll talk with you maybe right afterward just because I've run over here, if that's okay, sorry about that. Yeah, all right, great. How about we just sit for a minute, let it kind of sift in. May all beings be free. Thank you. It's good to be a gorilla.